Welcome to the Twisted Mirror. This is the season 3 finale, and I'll be back later this year with more Twisted Mirror. In the meantime, you can follow Twisted Mirror on Instagram, Facebook, or TikTok. I'll also still be posting bonus episodes to the Patreon. Now, without further ado, here is True Horror Liaison.
You are now staring into the Twisted Mirror.
Probably for as long as we could conceive of it, humans have attributed their misfortunes to some unseen force. Call it God, karma, whatever. If your crops failed, perhaps you had done something to anger the gods. If your family experienced a series of deaths or illnesses, you might have wondered if you were cursed. We need to make sense of it all. In some ways, it's more comforting to think that there is something you did to deserve your luck, because then maybe you can reverse your fortune. The random hand of death and despair is far more menacing. To think you could live a life of virtue and the person next to you one of malice, and yet they might die peacefully in their sleep in old age, while you toil through hit after hit, like Job? That can't be it. There has to be someone, something, pulling the strings. Today's true horror in many ways feels almost biblical. Two people unapologetically fulfilling their lustful desires find themselves smited by a mysterious force. This is True Horror Liaison. It was New Year's Eve, 1963. Ken and Ruth Nash were hosting a party to ring in the new year at their home in Chatsworth, New South Wales, Australia. Ken worked at Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, also known as CSIRO. There were 20 select people on the guest list with a diversity of interests, since the host hoped for riveting conversation. Some of the most brilliant minds in various fields of science and other intellectuals were in attendance. The first guest to arrive was a man named Dr. Gilbert Bogle, a former Rhodes Scholar and a physicist who drew high praise from his colleagues. His tenure at CSIRO, including a notable contribution to the production of a 21-centimeter Maser amplifier for use in radio astronomy, had his chief calling him the most brilliant member of the staff. With an appreciation for his talents, he was granted a leave of absence to pursue a 2-year appointment in quantum electronics at the Bell Telephone Research Laboratories in New Jersey, United States. Soon Bogle and his wife, Vivian Mary Rich, and their 4 children would be headed to his new appointment. But Dr. Bogle wasn't just brains. He was known as a personality. That night, he was described as the life of the party. Bogle was considered a handsome fellow, though I think his charm and wit was likely the greater factor in his appeal. Proof of this was his uncanny ability to attract a variety of women. As guests arrived, the Nashes would ask each guest to make an original art contribution, and Dr. Bogle drew his in the style of Picasso. At around 10 p.m. that evening, a couple walked into the fete. A bearded and casually dressed man, alongside his pretty brunette wife, wearing a ballerina pink dress adorned with a pattern of bright red roses, a dress she had purchased just several days before the party. They were Jeffrey Chandler, a colleague of Bogle's, and his wife, Margaret Olive Chandler, a former nurse. The couple had gotten a late invite to the party after a Christmas barbecue in Murraybank, 10 days earlier, where Bogle had gotten to chatting with Margaret Chandler. I imagine the scene was straight out of Mad Men, with well-dressed intellectuals rubbing elbows, cocktails in hand. But elbows wouldn't be the only thing rubbing that night. Because the perfectly coiffed hair, A-line skirts, and tweed jackets weren't the only thing that resembled an episode of Mad Men. About an hour and a half after arriving, Jeffrey Chandler slipped out of the party, alone, and got into his vintage Vauxhall to drive around in search of an open shop for cigarettes. His search for an open shop led him across town, near Balmain, where there was another party, at the home of Ken Buckley, a senior lecturer in economic history at the University of Sydney. Jeffrey found the Nash party a bit too highbrow and buttoned up for his tastes. He preferred a more laid-back, bohemian, and ruckus vibe. He also wasn't as far along in his career as many of the people at the Nash event and felt out of place. Mr. Chandler was associated with the Sydney Push, a left-wing libertarian subculture consisting of intellectuals, academics, blue-collar workers, students, musicians, artists, journalists, and even criminals. What linked this unlikely group was their disdain for conventional morality and authoritarianism. They did not subscribe to the traditional confines of marriage. Jeffrey felt more at home with the Push crowd at Buckley's party, and, oh, one other thing. There just so happened to be a guest at this party of particular interest to Mr. Chandler, Pamela Logan, a young secretary from Sydney, whom he had been seeing romantically for about 12 months at this point. From the party, they drove to her place in Darlington to have their own little private party. He wouldn't return to the Nash party, where his wife was, until 2:30 a.m. As he gallivanted with his girlfriend across town, Mrs. Chandler was busy entertaining or being entertained by someone else, one Dr. Bogle. Upon his return, Mr. Chandler touched base with his wife. He wanted to make sure that the night was going well for her and that she had a way to get home. He apologized for taking off without a word, feeling a bit conflicted about things, but according to him, she seemed unbothered. She simply asked him how the other party was. He then asked her impression of Dr. Bogle, to which she replied, "Yes, he's all right." She had been with Bogle for hours, and maybe she had had enough of the chatty, glib genius. She also mentioned that when she realized her husband had left the party and she had no money and no car, Dr. Bogle offered to give her a ride home. Perhaps surprisingly, Chandler did not take offense to his wife spending the night with the charming scientist. He thought himself to be liberated from the social mores of typical spousal relationships. He would not interfere as a white knight to sweep Margaret away. Margaret could make her own decisions, and if she decided she wanted to take up Dr. Bogle on his offer, he would not object. After all, he was in no moral position to act jealously considering where he had just spent his last few hours. Later, he noticed his wife and Dr. Bogle sitting together on a lounge chair, a cozy space for the pair. He got up and announced he would be leaving, implicitly giving Margaret the opportunity to join him. Margaret didn't make a move. Whatever small doubts Chandler may have had about her interest in Dr. Bogle, either within himself or from his wife, it appeared Bogle's persistence had paid off. Mr. Chandler confirmed with Bogle that he would take her home, and Bogle agreed. Feeling his wife was in good hands and that their body language implied she had made her decision, Mr. Chandler left the party discreetly, later admitting he was a bit embarrassed. He sat in his Vauxhall just outside of the party for a few minutes, wondering whether he had misread things and, quote-unquote, may have inadvertently left Margaret in the lurch. Eventually, he drove off. Mrs. Chandler and Dr. Bogle stayed back a bit longer, departing the party together at about 4 a.m. They made a point to leave separately. While Chandler's Sydney push crew had more libertine ideas about relationships, this party was a bit more conservative, and no one wants to be the center of party gossip. Some of the partygoers later claimed the two looked pale, but they were otherwise in good spirits. Before dropping off Mrs. Chandler at her Croydon home, though, the couple would make a detour to the Lane Cove River, an isolated spot and a popular lover's lane at the time. As for Jeffrey Chandler, he wasn't done with his night either. He drove back to Pamela Logan's home in Darlington, arriving at about 4:35 a.m., where he woke her up. Could she come with him to pick up his kids? He asked. Even affair partners get saddled with babysitting, apparently. She obliged and joined him to pick up the two Chandler children from their maternal grandparents' home in Granville. While she waited at a nearby road, he arrived at the home at 5:30 a.m. Olive Morfitt, Margaret Chandler's mother, asked about her daughter's whereabouts. He told her he had dropped her off at their home in Croydon. A lie, of course, but an understandable one considering his wife, her daughter, was spending the evening with a charming scientist, and his girlfriend was waiting down the road. From there, Mr. Chandler, the children, and Ms. Logan returned to her place, getting there at around 6 a.m. After their arrival, a woman from the party in Balmain, where he had first met up with Logan, came to the house and they shared breakfast. He wouldn't leave with his children until about 10 a.m. That same morning at around 6:30 a.m., there was a call to the police switchboard. Dr. Bogle's wife, Vivian Mary Rich, who had stayed home with a sick child, told the operator that her husband had not returned home from a New Year's Eve party. She wondered if there had been any traffic accidents. When Mr. Chandler got home late on the morning of New Year's Day, Margaret Chandler was not home. But he noticed a few things that led him to believe she may have stopped at the house. A single flower in a vase and a shade halfway pulled up. The flower in particular, he hadn't recalled seeing and thought maybe she had plucked it from the party and dropped it in. He thought the blinds were down before they left, but he couldn't be sure. He wasn't worried, though. Margaret may have spent the night with Bogle in their house and went back out for a morning drive. I gotta tell ya, these people have a lot of energy. It's impressive. It wasn't until about 1 p.m. that police knocked on the door of the Chandler residence. They asked to take him down to the station. They didn't say why, but half asleep, he complied. With Mr. Chandler and his two boys in the back seat of a police car, they drove in near silence. The next thing Jeffrey knew, he was being interrogated by the police at the station. They handed him the second edition of the evening paper. This was how he found out his wife and the mother of his two boys was dead, along with the man he had entrusted with her safety.
The policeman did not say to me what might seem to most of us the normal thing. Something like, for instance, "We are sorry, Mr. Chandler. We have bad news. Your wife is dead,"
Jeffrey Chandler stated, recalling the dizzying and devastating realization. Earlier that morning on January 1st, 1963, two teens, Michael William McCormick and Dennis Weeway, were on a morning hunt for lost golf balls. The boys split up, agreeing to meet up at some point. McCormick wandered alone until a small log obstructed his path. It was only while moving this obstruction, which caused him to glance to the side, did he notice a man lying face down by the riverside with a faint blue tint to his face. The 16-year-old figured it was a hobo, in his words, sleeping off a night of heavy drinking. It was New Year's Day, after all. He met back up with Weiwei, and they searched for another hour before coming across the man again. This time, his face was darker. He hadn't moved an inch since McCormick last saw him. Upon first glance, the man appeared clothed, but a closer inspection revealed his clothes were neatly laid over his body, like a paper doll. The teen noticed a piece of carpet peeking out from the man's jacket. This time they noticed he wasn't breathing and went to get help. I have to point out, there are many accounts you may find on a quick Google search that describe the body having no top on at all and just pants laid over the lower body, but this account is from the direct testimony of McCormick during the inquest, corroborated by other law enforcement testimony that were first at the scene. Police arrived and found the man, a shirt jacket, pants, and a carpet square resting on top of his body. When those items were lifted, he was completely undressed except for a loosened necktie, socks, and shoes. The body was in an advanced state of rigor mortis. There were a few drops of blood around his mouth. Flecks of excreta were on the body and vomit was found nearby. A few coins were on the ground near the body, indicating to law enforcement that the pants had been turned upside down before being set. Approximately 3 hours after Bogle's body was discovered and some 15 meters away, Mrs. Chandler's body was found, covered in flattened beer cartons. Her skin was warmer and her rigor mortis was not as advanced. Other than a few mild abrasions on her nose and shoulder, consistent with bumping into tree bark, there were no outward signs of trauma on her body. Underneath the cartons, her chest was exposed, and the dainty pink and red floral dress she had bought just days before to wear on New Year's Eve was rolled up to her waist. Her feet and knees were stained with mud. One report states that a pair of men's underwear was between her ankles. Some other things of note. Down by the riverbank, a pair of women's panties, a pair of brown women's shoes, and a belt was found. Human excrement was also found by the riverbank. Bogle's green Ford Prefect was parked nearby, the windows rolled down. Two marks consistent with a man's body being dragged, with his heels trailing into the mud, were found, and Dr. Bogle had mud on his heels. Multiple witnesses saw the two leaving between 4 and 4:15 a.m. With light traffic, it would have taken them about 6 minutes to reach this lover's lane from the Nash party. Investigators had a puzzling scene on their hands. It appeared, based upon first glance at the scene, that the couple may have been poisoned, perhaps by a jealous lover who then covered their bodies in a final act of remorse. Due to the holiday, it would take 3 days for the bodies to be examined and testing to be done. In the meantime, they had their man, the jealous husband whose wife spent the night entertaining a paramour. Cuckolded and humiliated, he must have waited for them to leave instead of going home, followed them to Lane Cove, and, well, that's what makes this mystery so enduring. What exactly happened and how? Usually a crime of passion displays signs of, well, passion, the pain of the heart manifesting as violence on the bodies of its objects. Poison? That takes planning and timing, a cool head. But Mr. Chandler worked at CSIRO, a place where smart people worked, the kind of people who may have had that know-how and access to chemicals. Perhaps he figured out a way. This seemed like an open and shut case at first glance. While the Sydney push crowd Mr. Chandler had been associated with was free-loving, Australia as a whole was still pretty conservative and not as accepting of extramarital relationships as the bohemian crowd. To police, it made sense that the husband would fly into a rage and kill the lovers. It was inconceivable that a husband would encourage or even accept a lover for his wife. As Mr. Chandler sat there in complete shock, the police went in on him for 10 hours, digging for a confession that never came. The widower insisted on his innocence, and he had an alibi. He was with a lover of his own on the other side of town, and he was seen by multiple people throughout the night, including his in-laws. And there was more the police didn't know. Mr. Chandler didn't just tolerate his wife's feelings for Dr. Bogle. He had given his blessing well before the party. His seemingly inconsiderate absence that night wasn't entirely self-serving. While he admitted his wife did not know Logan or the specifics of that relationship, these things tended to be complicated. While we now have social media groups and subreddits on polyamory and couples saying, "We saw you from across the bar and you look fun," ad nauseum, inspiring one of my favorite parody songs, "It's Never Who You Wanna Be Polyamorous Who's Polyamorous." Couples back then were often kind of winging the whole thing. It was simply an understanding without too much talk about specifics or rules. Dr. Chandler had taken a string of lovers over the course of their relationship. So when, after that Christmas party, his wife said to him, Gib Bogle was one of the most interesting people there and the thought of going to bed with Dr. Bogle was attractive, Chandler said she described this the way one might comment on an expensive car. Who was he to have any issue with it? He claimed he told her,
"If you want to take Gib as a lover, if it would make you happy, you do it."
The attraction wasn't a surprise to Jeffrey Chandler. Dr. Bogle was considered a handsome man, a socially magnetic polyglot with an intellect that was enviable, even among the elite intellectuals in his circle. He was known as a philanderer. He was the kind of guy even other straight guys kind of had a crush on. You know the old saying, women want to fuck him and men want to be him. While Jeffrey was getting his footing on the corporate ladder at CSIRO, Gil Bogle was a star. It was almost flattering that Margaret would have such tastes and that his Margaret captured the eye of such a man. A plan of sorts came together, though we can't be sure exactly how. But it is presumed Dr. Bogle felt that chemistry too because the Chandlers got a late-ish invite to the Nash's New Year's Eve party, suspected to have been encouraged by Bogle. Turns out, Mr. Chandler didn't quite abandon his wife at the party, at least not in the conventional sense. It was more like he was giving her some space. He admitted to the police he was playing wingman for his wife as he left her, only an hour to an hour and a half after arriving at the New Year's Eve party, in the company of the man she had expressed wanting to sleep with. It doesn't seem she was in on the specifics of that plan, as Chandler said he apologized to her upon his return. It was more of an improvised move. He stated when he checked in with her upon his return, he sensed she may have lost her enthusiasm for Bogle. But he didn't push the issue, not wanting to influence her decision and perhaps not wanting to engage in hypocrisy after his own activities. Nevertheless, in his absence that night, Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler had gotten to know each other much better, and despite some possible reservations, Margaret made no effort to leave with her husband when the opportunity was presented. Taking that as his hint to leave her with the man, Mr. Chandler asked Dr. Bogle if he would take her home, which kind of feels like it was an unspoken blessing from Mr. Chandler to Dr. Bogle, who, like Mr. Chandler, had no hang-ups about extramarital sexual relationships. The jealous husband theory continued to collapse as Chandler's support didn't just stop there. He specifically expressed that he stayed at Pamela Logan's house with the children until 10 a.m. to give his wife space if she chose to bring Bogle to the house. Something, again, that does not appear to have been explicitly planned, but assumed on his part. This explained his lack of concern when he returned home to her absence. Under typical circumstances for a married couple, this would have been a red flag, but to him, it might have been a sign that she had simply gone through with her plans. Later, Mr. Chandler would express regret that when he sat in his car those few extra minutes before leaving the party for good, he should have listened to his gut and gone back in for her. That he should have asked her explicitly about whether she was having second thoughts. That maybe this sophistication, this need to rationalize matters of the heart, to leave his wife with Bogle when he had sensed that maybe she had lost her zest for the whole thing, was what led to her death. After all, this might be hard now to believe for those who are strictly monogamous, and even more so back then. He claims they were happy. Jeffrey Chandler met and fell in love with Margaret at around the age of 26. A year after moving to Melbourne to work at CSIRO to work on Australia's first computer. Shortly thereafter, Margaret became pregnant and they got married. Though he doesn't characterize it as a shotgun wedding, it was simply the natural evolution of their relationship. Shortly after the wedding, when Margaret Chandler suffered a miscarriage, there were no misgivings about their commitment to each other, and they tried again for a child as soon as they could. At the time of the deaths, they had been married 6 years and had two young sons, and she was a loving mother to them. They were in the process of an extensive home renovation. They shared a love for vintage cars and dachshunds. She was the quiet, shy type, but neighbors all described her as happy. Mr. Chandler described her death as a great blow, and in the time following her death, became ill from the stress and grief of it all. Even after witnesses provided an alibi around the time of Bogle's death, estimated at around 5 a.m., when Jeffrey Chandler was with Pamela Logan on his way to his in-laws, and a 10-hour interrogation that turned up nothing, Australia exploded with this sensational story, and he was the public's number one suspect. The events had all the elements of intrigue: intellectuals and government scientists, mysterious deaths and taboo sexual relationships. Chandler would not get the type of sympathy typically afforded to grieving husbands. Much like the police who, while interrogating him for hours, could not understand the strangeness of a man allowing his wife to, in his words, be taken from a party at which I was present, it didn't sit well with the general public, sensing that even if there was no evidence, it had to be him. That would be the only thing to make sense of this senseless behavior. It was more comforting in a way to think that a man had killed his wife for sleeping around, rather than believing he simply supported her sexual exploration, that a wife might feel open enough to express her interest to her husband and not get slapped around or kicked out of her home, even while he was enjoying sexual explorations of his own. But we cannot, rather should not, convict people simply for their salaciousness or distasteful behavior. So the police had to let him go and begin exploring options outside of the jealous husband theory.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Now, let's get back to that night, shall we? Based on what was known of the crime scene, we can perhaps draw up a loose narrative for what happened that night. Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler left the party between 4 and 4:15 a.m. They got into his Ford Prefect and drove 6 minutes to Lane Cove River. But between getting in the car, maybe chatting a bit about what they would do next, like go to her place or somewhere else, maybe it took a little longer to get there. Now, Chandler said he thought his wife may have stopped at the house, but the evidence on that is scant. While he did leave the back door open for her, this was way before easily accessible communication like cell phones were around. So if they didn't explicitly discuss it, she would have had to assume her husband was the best wingman ever. Maybe she wasn't keen on taking the risk that her kids would be home, or maybe Bogle wasn't comfortable with it. With Bogle's wife at home with their sick child, that meant a lover's lane would be the best spot for a quick romp. So they parked their car and maybe got busy, or did they even have a chance? Whether it was before, during, or after getting it on, as they were both partially undressed, something happened. It was likely abrupt and sent them into a panic. Something made them both suddenly and violently ill. Due to the nature of the illness, it's likely they went running in opposite directions for privacy, explaining why they were found 15 meters apart. Maybe this was how the abrasions came to be on Mrs. Chandler's body as she ran through the dark woods. During this time, they were both overcome with vomiting, uncontrollable bowel movements, and even some bleeding in the case of Bogle. Whatever took them likely came fast and was painful. The autopsy results would reveal they had both died from acute circulatory failure. Whether their heart stopped before breathing or a cessation of breathing caused the heart to stop was unclear. What was certain was this was not the work of guns, knives, or fists. It had to be a chemical agent. Maybe experimental drugs gone bad? These were the LSD days, and maybe they both had a bad trip that led to a hysteria so mind-shattering it stopped their hearts? Or maybe it was a snake bite. This is Australia, where notoriously everything tries to kill you. The irony of sex and desire morphing into a grotesque illness paints a vivid picture. It was as if an Old Testament god had returned and struck them down for their lust, their infidelity, their lecherous ways. If that wasn't mysterious enough, there was the question about the state of their bodies. Very early on, it was suspected that Mrs. Chandler may have covered Bogle's body and then went to her spot and covered herself with the cardboard, resigned to her imminent demise. But that was dismissed quickly. She would have been too sick and in no state, mentally or physically, to neatly place his clothing over his body and then to walk about 15 meters away to lie down and die, leaving her breast exposed despite still having her dress wrapped around her waist, but then oddly taking on the more laborious task of shielding her body with a bunch of flattened beer cartons. It was clear there had been a third party at the scene, one who may have meticulously moved one or both of the bodies and covered them up so that their dignities would be preserved upon discovery. This is often taken as a sign that the killer knew or cared for the victims, and so the search was on for who this third person may have been. While lust may have been what led to the circumstances of the Chandler and Bogle deaths, lust was also responsible for the massive public interest in the case. A lust for answers, for details, and finger-pointing, and as is often the case for the unexplainable, theories abounded. Jeffrey Chandler was still regarded by many as somehow involved in the deaths. This included Margaret Chandler's family, who had no idea of the extramarital relationships. Chandler lied to his mother-in-law that night when she asked where her daughter was, and no doubt the realization that her son-in-law had told her her daughter was safe and sound at home, while at that very moment she was dead or in the process of dying, must have shattered her trust in her son-in-law. John Alexander Morfitt, one of Margaret's brothers, claimed that Chandler told him it is possible that she might have taken her own life. Morfitt said Chandler also told him,
"I feel I might be responsible for my wife's death, as she could have felt she was inadequate for me."
Another brother, Tony Morfitt, testified that he flew into Sydney as soon as he learned of his sister's death. The next day, he met with his brother-in-law, who introduced him to a woman, Pamela Logan. He claimed Chandler outright told him that this was the girl he was with on the morning of January 1st, and even referenced her as his girlfriend, a tactless move, no doubt, and one that would certainly make a grieving brother suspicious, and Chandler the object of the family's ire. Margaret's brother was convinced his brother-in-law had a hand in her death, but even law enforcement had to admit Mr. Chandler was most likely not their guy. As an inquest proceeded, Dr. Ogg, the medical examiner, had to admit after endless testing of tissues that included samples of all kinds of exotic poisons from all over the globe, he had nothing. There simply wasn't any poison he could find in their systems to identify how they had died. Their bodies were tested for radiation and yielded negative results. There was nothing in their blood to indicate they had taken drugs of any sort. No poison was found either. There were no bite marks on their bodies or venom in their blood. No gas like carbon monoxide was found either. The river was scoured for evidence such as needles, but nothing was found. This vacuum of physical evidence led to mass speculation. With the Cold War in full force, it was only natural espionage and Russian hitmen became a popular theory. In a version of this theory, Margaret Chandler was an innocent bystander as some secret government entity decided Gilbert Chandler knew too much. With access to resources that even a medical examiner would be unaware of, an undetectable poison designed to make quick work of the scientists was released. Some theorize with Bogle moving to the U.S., the Russians felt they needed to stop him before he took his big brain and special knowledge to their number one enemy. The problem with that is his colleagues insisted that while Dr. Bogle was brilliant, he was no secret agent. His work was not classified. It was widely used and results published available to those who wanted to seek it. Yes, his research could be used for military purposes, but so can many scientific findings. Not every piece of tech used by the military is a secret. Sometimes they source technology used in all walks of life, all over the world. Recreational drug use, such as LSD, was another contender, but testing ruled that out too. There had been witness accounts claiming to have seen the couple engage in interactions with people between leaving the party and arriving at the lake. Had someone slipped something to them then? Again, nothing was found in their systems. Plus, it was dark and most people had been drinking. Could such eyewitness testimony really be taken at face value? Was it a jealous former lover of Dr. Bogle's? A woman named Margaret Fowler, who was dumped by Bogle, was called to the stand. She was later dismissed by the judge as he deemed her testimony irrelevant. Felt it would only add to the spectacle of the inquest and wanted to preserve her dignity. I could go on with a long list of other theories, each one more obscure than the next. The police literally had thousands. But this is a case of the likely truth being far more interesting and tragic than any fiction one could conjure. After decades of zero progress into the cause of death for the couple, the Australian Broadcasting Company released a documentary called Who Killed Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler? In it, They claimed they had obtained new information that had finally led to the discovery of what killed the two. The answer had been there in front of them all along. The very river that had been a scenic backdrop to their final moments of passion and their last desperate breaths. See, the Lane Cove River wasn't just a lover's lane. In the early 1900s, during daylight hours, the river was once a bustling recreational hub. But something changed in the 1940s. People began to smell a noxious odor coming from the river, and residents even noticed their bath fixtures and paint were becoming discolored, as if by some chemical reaction. Children began to develop severe respiratory problems, some waking up in the middle of the night, gasping for air, along with other signs of illness. The government finally stepped in. Concerned residents might have to permanently relocate, and sent an investigator, Maurice Fry. As Fry was on the river collecting samples, he happened to witness a great disturbance in the water. Mud and silt swirled violently. Countless dead fish floated to the surface, and eels desperately tried to jump over the weir to get out of the toxic stew. It didn't take long for a trained scientist like Fry to recognize the culprit, easily identified by its pungent, egg-like stench, hydrogen sulfide. Hydrogen sulfide is interesting. At low concentrations, it's easy to smell. After all, its signature stank was what alerted the residents that something was amiss in the first place. At these low concentrations, it is not fatal and it warns you of its presence so that you can do something about it. But the irony, and what is counterintuitive about its effects, is that as the concentrations of it get higher, it becomes odorless to us as it affects parts of the brain associated with our sense of smell. So when we need to be alerted of its presence the most, it becomes undetectable without equipment, like a silent, invisible assassin. At these high concentrations, the toxin overwhelms its victim quickly, stealing the brain's ability to utilize oxygen. By the time you realize something is happening, it's almost always too late. You'll become violently ill, disoriented, unable to think critically or react, and essentially suffocate, despite oxygen being freely available. Fry concluded that a flour factory upstream had been dumping sulfurous waste into the river, unchecked. The building of a dam exacerbated the buildup as it stopped the natural tidal flows that diluted the waste. One might figure this would have led to a permanent solution for such careless handling of toxic materials. One might also be accused of being slightly naive. Something was done about it. The sewage was treated and routed to sewage lines, but inexplicably, I'm no engineer, so I literally cannot explain why other than carelessness, laziness, or frugality. Whenever there were heavy rains, an overflow valve opened. I believe the scientific term for it is a fuck it valve, and dumped the waste directly into the river. After all the investigating, the locals getting sick, losing a beautiful and safe recreational area, and a so-called solution, millions of gallons of waste were still being released into the river annually. About 30 years after the investigation of the river and an inadequate solution, it was still toxic and fish were still dying. And where did most of the waste happen to settle? You already know. Right by the popular Lover's Lane area at the center of this whole ordeal. Evidence from the scene painted a picture. There were shoes and underwear in a depression by the riverbed, shielded by mangroves. It would have been the perfect, private, cozy spot for two lovers. But this spot would have been the worst possible place they could have chosen that night. With hydrogen sulfide being heavier than air, it would have settled into the depression, and the very coverage that afforded them so much privacy would have limited airflow. How was this missed? The history of the river was public knowledge, and a huge amount of resources was dedicated to the investigation. It was very likely the scandalous circumstances of their deaths that had made the case a national sensation also influenced the withholding of key evidence in the case. During the investigation and inquest, information was withheld from the toxicologists by the coroner to, once again, preserve the dignity of the victims. Mr. Bogle's semen was found on his clothing at the scene. The sperm was a big clue for the timing of their deaths. It meant Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler had had enough time to engage in sexual acts, likely at the riverbed. This eliminated the likelihood that they were poisoned at the party or on the way to the river, theories that at the time, the medical examiner had to give equal weight. He may have focused more on the location itself had he known the more typical suspects, anyone they may have encountered before arriving at the lake, was unlikely. Most poisons act too quickly to allow two people to engage in sexual activity. The toxicologist may have looked at things differently during his 16-month search, had he known this information, maybe looking into modes of delivery outside of other human beings. The preservation of dignity may have led to years of speculation and suffering for the families left behind. Maybe this sounds too perfect, too clean of a theory, but there's solid evidence to support it. The toxicologist reported that their blood had a strange purplish tint to it, a sign of hydrogen sulfide poisoning if no other causes of death can be determined. At the time, he had examined the blood and found nothing, unaware that the cause of such a thing would be a gas. Examining their brains would not have yielded a result, as despite attacking it so aggressively, it leaves no signature in the tissues. One more thing. When law enforcement first tried combing the river, it was so dark and muddy that they had to stop and postpone the search for 11 days. This impenetrable darkness, like all the silt had been kicked up, looked much like the aftermath of the explosion Fry had witnessed that led him to discover the hydrogen sulfide toxicity in the first place, pointing to the fact that another event had likely just happened around the time of their deaths. And while this amounts to hearsay, a psychologist reported to Peter Butt, the filmmaker who produced the 2006 documentary on the case, that he had a client who, in 1965, 2 years after the incident, told him that she had seen a couple who had gone down to the riverbed to engage in sexual acts. She claimed to have seen them asphyxiate and smelled rotten eggs at the time. If this is true, this was decades before the hydrogen sulfide theory was uncovered, so it would not have simply been something taken from reading articles or watching press coverage of the case. If she saw two people dying, why didn't she help or report it? Well, she was at the lover's lane with another woman and came from a strict Catholic background. And reminder, it was the 1960s. To place herself at the scene with a woman would have likely been a terrifying proposition. Bogle and Chandler would have died rather quickly once exposed to the gas, and without understanding what was going on, there was likely little the woman could have done anyways. Going down to help them could have proven fatal to the woman as well. One of my favorite YouTube channels is that of the U.S. Chemical and Safety and Hazard Investigation Board, aka the USCSB. Yes, I know I'm strange, but seriously, they produce some of the best reenactments of workplace disasters. I even made a bonus Patreon episode on the topic. Hydrogen sulfide is involved in workplace disasters too, and one of the great tragedies is because it is odorless at high concentrations, a person will see their colleague collapse, usually in a poorly ventilated area, and run in to help, only to instantly succumb themselves. There was one incident where one by one multiple workers ran in after the other, all dying in their attempts to save the other. If this witness account is valid, it's likely the couple was at a higher elevation with better ventilation, and running down to help could have compounded the tragedy. Despite the case being headline news at the time, the psychologist claimed to have not made the connection until years later, when he came upon some coverage of the incident. Unable to breach confidentiality, the women would have to come forward themselves, but urged them to do so via the press, but there have been no updates. At this point, one or both of the women may be deceased, in very poor health, or still in the closet and unwilling to out themselves, or simply uninterested in being in the spotlight. Speaking of other people at the scene, what about the alleged third party? It looks like they weren't a KGB assassin after all. It's clear that the lovers couldn't have covered themselves so meticulously while experiencing such a violent and rapid demise. There were a few legitimate candidates for the mysterious third person. One, a voyeur who admitted during an interrogation that he had been peeping on the couple and believed Bogle had moved his vehicle away from him in response to being spotted. But the fellow was a persistent perv, as 30 minutes later, he approached the car again and claimed at the time that it was empty. As he drove down the path, he claimed he never saw them again. This story does track with the belief that the couple left the vehicle and moved to a more secluded area. He also only had one arm, so while one-armed people can still be very physically capable, the meticulous nature with which the clothing was placed, especially on Dr. Bogle, would have been a serious challenge for him. The other, more likely candidate was a greyhound trainer named Eddie Batiste. He often let his greyhounds illegally run free near where the bodies were found, but he told investigators he used a different path to get to the field than the one in which the bodies were found. However, Batiste's son claimed that his father returned home that morning, acting noticeably flustered. Batiste was known as a man of strict principles, and it would line up with his personality to have covered the exposed bodies of Bogle and Chandler. According to the documentary on the case, his obituary in a 1977 issue of Greyhound magazine, which had gone under the radar for some time, I assume because Greyhound magazines don't circulate as widely as, say, the New York Times, stated explicitly that he had discovered the bodies. Now, whether this was written solely on the assumption of his family or that he later admitted it, we can't be sure. Though I don't think it's hard to imagine that once the dust had settled and his son grew older, he might have admitted to what he had done. Being witness to something like that weighs on a person. Ultimately, there will never be a 100% conclusive answer to that question. But it is pretty much agreed amongst all who have investigated the case that the third person was simply a bystander who did not want to publicly reveal themselves, but did take pity on the state of the couple and did a very human thing, gave the couple a little bit of privacy, perhaps the last bit they might ever have before their bodies would be officially discovered and all the titillating details of their lives would be aired for the world to know for decades to come. Perhaps he also wanted to spare the next person or persons who found them, which interestingly enough would end up being two teenagers. One must remember this was long before the days of true crime everything and forensic analysis being a regular part of entertainment. So he may not have even realized that he could have been tampering with the scene in a way that could hinder an investigation. What likely happened that early January morning was the confluence of several unusual events. A woman who was perhaps on the fence about a lover's tryst, deciding to steal away to a secluded lover's lane instead of her safe, empty home. A factory that used a beautiful river, a source of fun for the community and home to countless aquatic lives, as its toilet, releasing toxic levels of a deadly, undetectable chemical, building up to a release at that precise moment when two lovers would lie in a cozy depression, a death trap. And a stranger who just so happened to come upon the bodies and performed a sympathetic gesture, that would end up adding intrigue to the mystery and muddy the waters of the investigation, pun fully intended. After all the scandalizing and speculation, their deaths were likely just a bizarre and tragic accident. It wasn't a wrathful god mysteriously swooping down to punish the sexually deviant, or a hitman who wanted to keep trade secrets secret. It wasn't a wild LSD trip gone bad. It was the banality of greed and carelessness that killed Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler. Whatever one may think of their acts that night, infidelity is not worthy of the death penalty, whether it be from some deity or a polluted river. These were people who had more to give, a quiet, loving mother of two children who loved cars and dachshunds and was looking forward to enjoying a newly renovated home with her family. A charming and brilliant rascal, a father who was just entering the prime of his career. Who knows what developments and breakthroughs could have come from his work? While the public speculated for decades about the deaths, there were living victims, the families left behind. Vivian Mary Rich, Dr. Bogle's widow, kept a low profile after the death of her husband. Shortly after the inquest, she left with their children back to her home of New Zealand to lead a life of relative anonymity. Despite there being no proof of any wrongdoing, a dark cloud loomed over Jeffrey Chandler's reputation. His budding career never quite recovered from the association and the general public sentiment that he must have had something to do with the crime. He recalled how difficult it was to try and move past the trauma with his two young sons, how every New Year's Day the headlines about the mystery would resurface, and the Chandler boys would have to revisit not only the death of their mother, but the public's rehashing of the scandalous details of the circumstances that surrounded her death. The boys were very young at the time. One was just a toddler and the other an infant. The infant in particular did not remember his mother, but inevitably the damage of losing her surfaced.
All three of us suffered quite severe emotional and psychological damage arising from this event,
Mr. Chandler said. Jeffrey Chandler, who had a chilly relationship with his own family, had been taken in by the Chandler clan when he married Margaret. Margaret and her three brothers supported him as he pursued a bachelor's in engineering and then a master's. He truly felt at home with them, but all that was lost after her death. They believed he had something to do with it. And this is just my armchair psychoanalysis, but regardless of whether or not they felt they knew exactly how he might have killed her, they simply may have blamed her for his lack of protection, for the perceived disrespect to their loved one with his extramarital affairs, and for allowing her to go with Bogle that night in the first place. Whether he held the poison himself or not, one could see how a family in grief would hold him responsible for the circumstances that directly led to their loved one's demise. Tony Morfett, in response to his beloved sister's death, turned to religion. And of course, people have every right to turn to religion for comfort, but in one article, a writer who befriended him after the deaths described it as less of a comfort and more of an obsession. Every conversation turned to Jesus to the point where it had become intolerable and he had to terminate the friendship. For what it's worth, Chandler rejected the Morfitts family offer to adopt the couple's boys. Chandler, in quick succession, found himself a widower and with no family to lean on. Eventually, he wrote a book that is no longer in print called So You Think I Did It. Some found it to be in poor taste. The cover featured a close-up of Chandler, cigarette between his lips, revealing an impish grin. But I can't really blame someone who was given such an unfair shake for wanting to put his side of the story out there and possibly having to do whatever it took to financially support his children in the wake of a massive reputational blow. In the book, he says,
I want my sons to know the truth, because the truth is the one thing that cannot harm them. I cannot tell them what caused their mother's death, but I can tell them the facts once and for all, and what sort of woman their mother was, and what sort of man I, their father, am.
Margaret Chandler was cremated at the Northern Suburbs Crematorium shortly after her body was released to her husband. A brief, intimate service was held with fewer than 12 mourners before she was cremated. Dr. Bogle was buried in Northern Suburbs Cemetery. Approximately 30 mourners, including his widow, attended the funeral.